Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 32, Through the Samhain Portal with Robert Mulhall. After an early autumn pause, we're back with new episodes, just in time for Samhain. Now, if you're a Knot Work listener, you probably know this word. You know that Samhain is the original name for the festival we now know as Halloween. You've heard the stories of the ways in which the veils are thin at this time of year. This is when we are able to reach out and touch the other world. It's the time when the ancestors can reach through the veil and touch us. So in the spirit of Samhain, I'm excited to bring you this conversation with Robert because in so many ways, he really lives the myths that are part of him. A little bit more about our guest. Robert Mulhall has spent the last two decades in such diverse industries as public health, leadership development, education, finance, organizational consulting, and executive coaching. He's now the CEO of the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. Originally from County Wicklow, Robert holds a bachelor's degree in commerce, accounting, and business management from the University College Dublin. He's a certified public accountant in Ireland and certified in meditation, executive coaching, the Enneagram, Reiki, and Celtic Irish shamanism. Well, I am so happy to welcome Robert to the podcast today. And as you know, on Knot Work, Myth, and Storytelling, we generally ask a story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways that it still matters and resonates. But after a bit of a pause, I'm excited to come back to you with one of our Myth Workers and Culture Makers series conversations, because Robert is someone who so truly lives mythology in such a beautiful and profound way that I knew he'd be the perfect one to come and have this conversation with us. So Robert, welcome. I'm so glad to have you here with us today.
Yeah, delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. So it feels important to sort of name that we're standing together at the Samhain portal. You know, we're recording this towards the end of October. We're really feeling those veils between the world being thin. I'm curious, for you being in Western Massachusetts, I'm here in upstate New York in the Hudson Valley. We feel this energy here, albeit being 3,000 miles away from Ireland. How is it present for you right now?
Well, even the feeling of 3,000 miles away, I've been talking to somebody in the north of Ireland recently, and they were saying that there's an international Appalachian Trail, and it is actually like in, goes through the north of Ireland. And I was like, oh my God. And then somebody was saying, the Atlantic separates these two continents. And I was thinking, oh, the Atlantic joins these two continents. So it actually feels really close, not close enough for me to jump in a car and drive to, obviously. It's a little, logistically a little bit harder, but I feel Eru very closely this time of year, but all times of year. So I'm blessed in that way. Mm. And, but Samhain, I love Samhain. I've always loved Samhain. And it just feels like it's that invitation under. And sometimes that feels like an invitation under the duvet. I'm just like, that's, thank you. And then it's that invitation. I don't know if you've ever gone surfing and you come off the board, the wave comes over and it just like pulls you under the wave. And you're like, you're down in the water and you're not sure if you're coming back up. That feeling also. And I think I've got both of those going on right now. Feeling of being pulled into more slowness and quieter movements in life while still trying to meet my obligations and responsibilities. And I can feel the deeper pull, which is always an invitation into transformation and often initiation.
Yeah.
I had a dream last night. I had many dreams last night, but the one that I can really still bring back is, and I was lucid dreaming, so I was just watching myself dream and sort of participating in it in some ways. And I was falling through the sky as if like I had fallen out of an airplane. There was no sense of actually falling out of an airplane, but I was falling from a great height, not just like 100 feet. It was thousands and thousands of feet. And I was just falling. And I was watching the part of my mind that was afraid that it was falling and that was trying to figure out what was coming. I was trying to figure out what was coming. I was trying to figure out, like, where's the ground? Where's the ground? But the awake part of me that was watching this was talking to that part of me and just saying, just fall, just fall, just fall. It was exquisite. I think I was doing like therapy to myself in some way last night. It was incredible. Yeah.
And it was given to you in triplicate. So it was a true invocation. It gave you a sense of locating in time. Like, it's just fall. It's just autumn. No big deal. And I realize I'm vamping because even as you said that, my palms started to get sweaty because I'm a heights person. So yeah. I just got sweaty palms over your lucid dream, which is kind of the miracle of dream share in general. And just these bodies of ours that know how to respond to the depth and to the everything.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing you mentioned, just that sense of like, you know, that desire at this point in time, like what we want to do is just go within. And sometimes it's just under the duvet. And it just reminds me of like, of course, that's why we have our literate cultures. Like we can go under the duvet with companions and those great journeys. And I've got a stack of books. Please don't disturb me again until in bulk at the soonest. Right. And then, of course, there is that sense of, I think you really named it well, like, we do have to stay out of bed and stay engaged in the world. And what happens when the underworld has got us by the ankle and is, you know, kind of saying, but come, you have this other soul work to do.
Yeah.
And it's this impossible beauty of what we get to pull off in any given day, many days, to try to be in both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's just critical that I spend daily time in that practice, allowing myself to be pulled into any world in meditation or imrams and journeys and prayer. I don't think I could navigate this ordinary world without the non-ordinary world time. And then I've got a lot of blessings and privilege in my life, so I get to create some space to go deeper. And so soon I'm hoping to go spend time alone in nature, just to be with some big questions. Yeah.
And that was, you know, you and I got to spend time together at Kripalu just a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that you not only mentioned, but just embodied in such a beautiful way that I was just so grateful to sort of just kind of absorb is that sense of naming ceremony and ritual as part of your daily lived life. Yeah. And as well as knowing that that was part of your work as a leader, as someone who's part of a community that's holding space for community, that's being held by community, and the beautiful level of self-consciousness you brought to wanting that to always be and needing it to be in conversation with divine forces, with the source.
Yeah.
And that just, we don't get to have those conversations very often and sit with the truth of that. And I so appreciated that.
Yeah. I grew up in Ireland, obviously, and born in Kilwanton and Wicklow. And I had a very different sort of upbringing where I was exposed to broader spirituality than sort of the Catholic Church in Ireland. And so that meant I was kind of out spiritually amongst my friends, and they all thought I was different and or weird. But I guess I got to be a bit of a pioneer around what it's like to be sort of out in my spirituality. And when I moved to New York back in 2012, I remember being on a rooftop and somebody came up to me. It was like some fun rooftop barbecue that I don't get invited to anymore. And somebody said, they came over and sort of whispered to me and they said, I heard you meditate. And I was like, why are we whispering? And they said, well, do you meditate? And I said, yeah, I meditate. And they said, oh, I do too. And I said, I still don't understand why we're whispering. And they said, well, nobody knows that I meditate. I said, what? do you think they'll like not be friends with you? And this was 2012 when, you know, people, there was a lot of people meditating globally, but in westernized world, not a lot. And then this happened a few times. I said, oh, there's all these people that are like sort of shy about their spiritual practice because society isn't giving us permission and we're not taking that permission. And I understand currently, historically, why we're shy about our claiming our spirituality, especially if it doesn't fit into the mainstreams. Mm-hmm. And so myself and a few friends started an organization in New York called Friends with Spiritual Benefits. And we would meet once a month in someone's apartment, and it would be meet for 2 or 3 hours, and we would just explore different aspects of spiritual practices. And somebody would come and lead a guided meditation, or somebody would come and lead something else, creative expression, mm-hmm. whatever it was. And it was great. And all these people got to be like having these conversations. And I think people are really thirsty and hungry for it. There's such a poverty of it in our media, in our economic system, in pretty much everything. So I love to keep talking about it as much as possible.
Yeah. And especially because we know that so much of our worldviews are ruled by the algorithms, and without getting into this, a very boring conversation in some ways, but it's also just, it is still that sense of the lens through which we view the world. I have to remind myself of like, oh, wait, not everybody's thinking about this stuff all the time. It's just that I've trained the robots to feed me that, and that's pretty much all they think that I want. And it ends up being those constant moments of, well, I've told this story on the podcast before, I'm sure, but my very first blog was called The Girl Who Cried Epiphany, because it was this idea of rediscovering something you already knew and having to discover it again for the first time. But again, it's in this conversation of, right, just though we may surround ourselves by the certain folk who consume the same media, who are into the same stories, who go to the same retreat centers, there's that recognition of there's so much further for the stone to ripple out.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly struck by that, because you can see the poverty at the cultural level in some ways, but then you're also with so many, at least in probably our immediate circles, of folks who are well-fed spiritually. And I think there's that huge space in between that we lose track of, because it's, I guess it's the unseen to take us back to this.
Yeah. What I love about myths and myth working is how disruptive it is. Or how disruptive it can be if we engage with it rather than just tell it like a story.
Yeah.
And I often think about what's the personal myth, and how am I like disrupting my own myth and my own story? And I think that's a big part of this work as well. And I think it's a big part of the sort of Irish way of approaching life, is there's a natural disruption to things. Too much order is sort of unacceptable. And like Samhain's so beautiful for that, right? It's the time when society has that permission to be chaotic, to be upside down, to be turned inside out, for things not to make sense. And God, our ancestors knew something. They were like, we need that expression. And if we don't have that expression, then we'll be too maybe binary or too linear, too boxed in. And right, what you don't express, that doesn't come forward, that can really cause a sickness in us.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many ways to go with this, but I think I want to ask you, in terms of, you know, what stories, what myths have shaped you either over many years, or any stories that are really up for you right now that really feel as if they're present and shaping your consciousness, your experience?
Ah, so many. I think about the Bhagavad Gita a lot. And Arjuna and Krishna, and this adamant that he doesn't want to fight. He doesn't want to cause harm. He doesn't want to kill his brothers and cousins. And his spiritual teacher, Krishna, is telling him that he must do his duty. That's his spiritual work, is to do his duty. There's much more to it, but that there is liberation in doing your duty. Yeah, I think about that a lot in these times. What is my duty and service? And I grew up with this tension. I used to have this debate with my dad, who's crossed over, and because he would sometimes, I would sort of quote Jesus to him, and we'd go into like theological, spiritual dialogues with each other. But, you know, he would talk about some war that was happening in the world, and I would say, but Jesus would say, turn the other cheek. Mm-hmm. And he would say, but Krishna would say, do your duty. And you'd be like, I was like, and I've never married those two together. And so that is those myths together. It's almost like it's not just one. It's like when those myths start to, those waters start to come together.
Yeah.
You get like the brackish water or the brownish water and the clear water. And they just haven't, inside of me, I have not found the place of reconciliation, which, you know, to that point of myths can cause disturbance, can cause disruption. I think it keeps me in a healthy state of disruption. So I don't go into that place of now I know.
Because
it keeps me curious in every moment, in every circumstance.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Moriarty said about how we're meant to be harrowed by the myths, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the salmon of knowledge is working me a lot.
Mm.
I got to spend time in August this year out west in the Burren, all over, but I was out in the Burren and went to Coleman's bed and spent some time in his bed in prayer, and then went up behind to the hazelnut forest. And I'd never sat in a hazelnut forest before. Sat in so many forests, and this was just beyond a divine experience. So close and so warm and so like otherworldly all at the same time.
Yeah.
So I can feel the hazel and the salmon working me from there, but not at a cerebral level. It's like at a cellular level that I don't even know yet. And maybe in 7 years' time, I'll have a sense of it.
How many more visits might it take back? Or is it enough to hold it in your heart? Like both things are true, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you and I have this funny little connection we've had over the last couple of years where we have been visiting the same sacred sites within about 2 weeks of each other. And we keep realizing on Instagram, I'm like, wait, I was just there. Oh, I'm going there next week. And I have unfortunately not made it to any hazel groves next, but I'm going to just continue to hope that three times is a charm. And I'm just going to keep following you, you know, a little while later on the same journey.
Well, when I was in the Kesh Caves in Sligo, my great-great-grandmother, Mary O'Brien, on my mother's father's side, she came through to me, and she sometimes works with me and gives me beautiful pointers. And she came through and she said, well, first of all, the caves sort of said that this was the end of the pilgrimage that you took to Rathcrochran and to the Cave of Cats and Gat, which is right, Samhain and all the birth. Well, one of the certainly one of the honorings of Samhain in Ireland. We like to have birthplaces, lots of birthplaces for lots of things, but that the Kesh Caves were somehow the end of that portal. And then as I was there, Mary O'Brien comes through and she said, you must go to the caves in the west of America, Turtle Island. And so I went out there in May of this year, and I happened to go there for work, and I took a weekend off, and I went and went to some of the caves in Canyon de Chelly in Arizona, and then Bandelier in New Mexico. And these are caves connected with the Diné Navajo people in Arizona, and then the Pueblans in New Mexico. And when I put my head against the stone of the canyon walls or in the caves of Bandelier, it was the same voice as the caves in Kesh Caves. And these caves were just saying that we are the same, and we're all actually like places of communication. It was almost like the telephone system in some way. It was very profound and beautiful. So there's something, I don't even know what that is yet, but there's something sort of being worked in me around these caves as well.
Oh, thank you for the gift of that, you know, and for whether anyone's listening has been to those sacred spaces or not, we now get to hold them within us because we're always held within those spaces. And I went into Owenagat with my daughter in 2016. And so if you don't mind, I might borrow Mary O'Brien's voice and say, what if that was the beginning of one journey? And I brought my second daughter to the caves of Kesh 6 years later. So I might be borrowing that as a bit of a chance to keep journeying. And I went back to Kesh again this year because I knew I wasn't done. Because these places, well, we know how our relationships with places and spaces work. And then we don't know, right? It's that sense of, I must keep visiting. I must keep visiting. Oh, not this time.
Yeah. It's sweet and simple and direct, and but you got to be humble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing work in progress for me. Can I be humble?
Yeah.
I'd set myself, I learned on Gaeilge in school in Ireland, but it was the school I went to prioritized other languages. So this was like low down on the, mm-hmm. on the list. So I never gained any sort of skill or fluency around it at all. And, but I set myself a challenge to gain fluency again by the age of 50. So it's a generous timeline, mm-hmm. but just every day working through it. And with Moncon passing over recently, I was reading something and it said that there's no verb to know in the Irish language. You can't know something the way you know something in English. And it's like, we can say, I understand, and all of these, like Higham or whatever, but to know something in the same way that the way the English uses to know. And I'm sure there's some Gaeilge that's going to be like, that's not correct. But again, we don't let the truth get in between us and a good story. Okay. So there was something about that that I was like, oh, that's so true, that there's like, even when I am with Irish people, there's like this, there can be a deep certainty, but there's usually, even though we can be stubborn as hell, there's just some space for not knowing and not holding on to things so tightly.
Do you think that's something around like a sense of relationship to the other world and that sense of knowing that culturally the unseen is so nearby?
I think it's definitely about that, but I also think it's about this world. Like, what's the weather going to be like today in Ireland? I don't know. Just wait. And how the language is so connected to the elements and to the nature that it was spoken on. And yeah, so I think it's as much about the other world as it is this world, that there is an uncertainty in Ireland. Like, there's just an uncertainty in it. And there's been uncertainty in its history for such a long time. There hasn't always been a clear path forward. I don't know if maybe we have just a sense of an illusion of a bit more of a clear path forward now, but probably not in reality. But that sense of allowing ourselves to not know, like the other way of saying that is that we just invite the mystery.
Right.
On the spirit, we invite Dia Bandia into the conversation, spoken or not, in some way in Ireland. Like, I love it. You go to somebody and say, do you believe in the spiritual world or the spirit world? And they're like, no. And you go, okay, you go down, cut down that Hawthorne tree. And they're like, absolutely not. Yeah. Right. Like, okay, so what's in it? Is it just superstition? What's underneath that superstition is usually some ancestral cellular sense of not, don't do that.
Yeah. And when you put it that way, I think I realize how much I learned that by going over and adopting Ireland as my, you know, as my heart's homeland. Yeah. Because, you know, we live in a place here, you know, being in Turtle Island, being on colonized land, like, that uncertainty ought to exist in this place in the same way. But as, you know, part of the white settler class, it is taken, that sense of unknown is taken for granted and obliterated. Because, of course, this history is a history. It's all written and it is what it is. And that certainty is part of an American identity that is, once you start to point it out, it can feel a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Look, the westernized, which is not exclusive to the United States of America at all, sometimes they just sort of make it bigger,
louder,
more pronounced maybe. Mm-hmm. But if you don't hold on to, if you don't have roots, if you have forgotten your roots, then you've got to control, and certainty is control. That's my thinking on it. And so we have to take away the mystery. We have to take away the not knowing. There's no space for it. And, you know, the United States of America right now is deeply divided. And it's that division is based on knowing. Mm-hmm. I am right. You are wrong. Mm-hmm. I am this. You are that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ireland's obviously had a lot of history of separation and division. But we found a way to like collapse that just enough for there to be some peace, certainly at a political level. And I think that's maybe because enough of us didn't stop listening to the land, didn't stop listening to the waters, didn't stop listening to the trees and the stones.
Yeah.
And the indigenous Native Americans on Turtle Island, this is what they've been trying to tell everybody, tell all of us the whole time. And this is where the humility is. They are so, so clear that humility is a deep part of walking with spirit. Any of the beautiful folks that I've been able to speak with, and Westernized spirituality doesn't have that same humility at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's very much an individual game, an individual game of healing, an individual process of perfection, which is just painful, ultimately lonely and painful.
Yes, 1,000 times yes. And I so appreciate that coming from you as someone who's so at much at the heart of a space where people go to practice self-care and have self-realization. And yes, it's held within community, but the paradox is so very present in our wellness worlds as they've been constructed in the 21st century. And there's so much good there, and there's shadow.
Yeah. And Apollo, I don't think of us in the wellness world. I think of us in the, we're here to educate people about ancient wisdom, which is about whole being and liberation. And you may experience well-being along the way.
Right.
But there will be times when you definitely don't feel well. And that might be physical because you're something happening. There'll also be many, many times when you're just under that wave for longer than you think you should be or could be. Yeah, I've had many, many of those experiences in life. And this was like, wow, this path is not for the faint of heart.
Right, right. It's not all, glowing chakra rainbows and the angelic singing. Not surprisingly enough, exactly. It's the real path.
And that's what I love about, you know, the Samhain and the start of the year. It's just like, come walk into darkness. But there's a wombness to that, right? It's not just about the unknown of the darkness and the sort of the Buddhist void. It's that also the loving sort of womb of the darkness too. It's kind of got it all.
Yeah. The fertile dark that will eventually take us to the light invariably year after year.
And I keep saying to people right now, it's like, don't rush your winter.
Yes.
Even if that doesn't align with what the weather and the seasons are doing right now, just whatever winter you're in, don't rush it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is radical in an age of global warming, isn't it? Right? We all, it's rushing everywhere. I keep seeing my own version of this, but I would love to hear yours because I know you'd mentioned that you've done a lot of work with the Triskela and being with that image. And am I saying that right? That's a word I've always struggled with. How do you say that T word?
Well, the T word, I am going to say it as Triskela, but that doesn't mean I'm right.
I feel like everyone has their own spin on it, which in a way is wonderful. We can be with the unknown. But I've heard you mention in a couple different spaces and places that you've worked with that symbol for a while. Yeah. And for some reason, that really feels present for me. And I wonder if we can explore that a little bit.
Yeah, I spent many years working just with the spiral symbol and the flow of the spiral and continue to. And then something started to happen. One of my journeys back home to be with family and to be with the time on the sacred sites. I was out by, the oceans, the wild Atlantic and the Irish Sea. And she was just calling me in a different way that I'd never been called before. And I hadn't really spent much time like with her energy directly, spent more time with the mountains and the rivers and the forests. And then Mananaan MacLear started to come through. And I didn't know he had any connection with the Triskela until I learned later. But he showed me the Triskela. And then I was in ceremony and the Triskela started to come through very, very deeply. And I'd always held these connections with different animals and sort of different traditions. And the Triskela started to show the trinity of all of these things that have been happening in my life all the time. And I, from a very young age, had a very deep connection with the puma and the mountain lion, just that energy and that archetype, like from the age of 6 in Wicklow. Can't explain. I can sort of tell you how I got there, but that just came in.
The neighbors had a black cat? No.
Yeah. No. Well, maybe, actually, to be fair. But just close my eyes and that's all I would see. Mm. And I walked with that for a long, long, long time. Mm. But then sort of the jaguar started to come through much, much more. And at the same time, wolf came through. Mm. And then I was in a ceremony once and it just showed the three of them in this trinity. Mm. Everything just kind of collapses for me with the Triskela. It's like it takes out, it holds the yes and the no and the maybe. And this, what is it, the inner arch, the sort of the other space, like the Triskela has that in it for me. It's like you can have two pieces to it, but then there's this other space. And is that something else, or is that the sort of the mystery or the dynamism or the space between them? And yeah, so it's, yeah, for the last few years, that one's been working me in this beautiful way and just showing more and more of, I think maybe back to what we were saying a minute ago, of just this power of the sort of the inclusion and at the same time, just the not knowing.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. And it feels like a beautiful invitation at this time of year, you know, in the north where we're getting into the real deep darkening of the skies. And, you know, I think wherever we are in the world, if the Celtic drumbeats hit us, then it's that sense of the darkening of the wintering of the soul comes in. And it just feels like just that opportunity just to talk about the power of a symbol itself and just be with it in that way and take it seriously, I suppose, in the sense of like, what do we have from the ancestors? Yeah. So little. We have some stone structures. We have their carvings. We have scraps of story. Go back to what we can see and we can run our fingers along and it's going to be the spirals and the chevrons and the triskels.
And some people say in Ireland that, you know, we lost a lot of through colonization, etc. We lost a lot. Mm-hmm. And yes, and put your head against the cave wall in Sligo, or your back against an oak tree in Wicklow, or whatever it is. Climb Crochan Eagle, also known as Crowpatrick in the West. And there is nothing quiet about these places. And they're all still, you can hear the songs, and you can hear the wisdom and the direction. And I don't think that's new stuff. I think it's all old and ancient.
Yeah.
And can we be humble enough to hear it and receive it? And then also be humble enough to write it down and trust it, to say, this is true. I didn't learn it from somebody. I didn't learn it from a course. I didn't get certified in that. But can I trust my own experience and be humble enough to check ourselves in that process and say, is there any whisper of sort of grandiosity in this?
Yeah.
Is this, am I actually just allowing the land to speak through me, or am I sort of co-opting that for my own gain?
Am I using the story in order to prove the point?
Yeah.
It's something you just offered, and maybe it's a rephrasing, and maybe it's just another trinity of a tangent. But I'm hearing in that too is that, and it's often what I come to with myth work, is this sense of, well, there's the story as we have it written down to the best of our ability. That's the quote unquote truth, because it's what the redactors did and the scribes and the this and the that. And then there's that visionary sense of what comes through in, when we're being unkind, we can call it that unverified personal gnosis. And when you're naming it, it really has that sense of transmission and soul language. And then it feels like perhaps there's that third way of how we can then draw it together with humility and openness and an awareness of what our roots are and what we can know in this world from the ancestors and what they wrote down and passed on, and then how we can weave that sort of trinity knot into the next offering and to ourselves and to whoever else is ready to perhaps receive it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you used the words earlier on around the like colonization and referencing that I live in Turtle Island, North America. And that's been such a journey. You know, I've now lived here, 13 years, and which is wild. And when I came to the United States of America, you know, I wasn't coming from a conversation, you know, Ireland, they do a really good job of sort of Irish history and global history. So you understand a lot. And my parents, here's a confession, when my parents would leave the house sometimes, I would get my dad's Martin Luther King sermons book and then walk around the house speaking them out loud. And then like when my parents would come home, I'd like hide the book and pretend I was watching TV. I'm an unusual person. And so I knew more than most, but still knew nothing when I came here. And when I landed here, I started to hear a lot of folks saying, European ancestry, say, I'm an American mutt. And I would start to cry. I can feel it now. I would start to cry. And they were like, why are you crying? I said, because you just told me that your lineage is German and Irish and French and Welsh and Lithuanian and whatever else. And I said, that means you're this like conduit for six cultures that are that have so much richness and beauty in them.
Right.
And that was like the first thing. I was like, wait, what is going on here? Like, what it? People don't know who they are or where they come from. And just didn't have that experience growing up in Ireland. I know who I am and where I come from. And then it was just like, then I had to wake up to the fact that I was white in America. Right. And because I couldn't, it's not appropriate or helpful for me to keep going around saying, but I'm Irish. Because I get all the privileges of a white male in this country. Regardless of where I was born. And so I sort of started to go into this like, okay, so what does it mean to walk with that label, but not to identify myself as that? To identify myself with that, to create more sort of bravery in spaces for folks, but not to enable, not to become white in that process.
Right.
To be still a Celtic Gael. And pre-Celtic. And so that has been this whole journey. You know, there's such rich, deeply important work around equity and inclusion and belonging and diversity and justice in the United States in particular, because of its like brutal history around the genocide of the Native American indigenous people and the enslavement and the Atlantic slave trade, etc., for African American relatives. And one of the things that's becoming clearer and clearer to me is that if people with European ancestry in North America don't go back to their remembering in some way, pull the songs forward, not the sort of popular cultural songs, like the songs with depth and the songs that like move your heart, like literally turn your heart inside your chest. The spiritual ways and practices, the way of seeing and understanding the world, which starts to, when you collapse it down below the cultural level, starts to look and feel really, really similar and universal.
Yeah.
If we don't do that in this country, I don't think we're going to get the change and the peace that we need. I think we'll, because the dominant population is European, of European ancestry, and they are not through anybody's fault at this point. They've inherited separation.
Right.
I'm sure into their like epigenetics at this point. They've inherited separation into the cellular level of who they are or of what their bodies are experiencing. And that creates the view of separation. And how do we help people with European ancestry reconnect with the beauty of their culture, which also then stops exploitation and appropriation of all of these other cultures? And I had the incredible privilege of doing some work with some folks from First Nations here in Massachusetts. And they were talking to them. I said, one of the reasons European descended folks are obsessed with your culture is because they feel such a poverty in their own lives around it.
Right.
And there's something in them that goes, I remember something that felt a little like this. And I'm so desperate for it because that's where the wholeness is. not from something that's missing that gets completed, but that wholeness gets remembered inside of us when we reconnect with our land and our rich spiritual ways. And I don't believe that there may not be people that are able to teach people. Like, there are places, Ireland, Scotland, Wales holds like a potency around of teachers and people that have carried this on, which is incredible considering the oppression and colonization that happened in those countries. But maybe we're like the luckiest of the oppressed to be able to have kept that going, or the stubbornest, or who knows. But there are other places. I'm sure you go to Switzerland, that's probably much harder to find. Much harder. And I can't speak like Spain. I don't know, but I'm sure. Yeah. I just feel like Ireland's got a great reputation for it.
Yeah.
But even if there's nobody to do it, the land is there, and she'll re-educate us.
Yeah.
We just have to spend time on her with that intention, and these songs will come through. And to that point of like, can be humble enough to listen and receive, and then also humble enough to trust that that's what we're receiving is our ancestral ways again. And I think if we can do that in North America, something different is possible.
Your lips to the mountain's ears, and your lips to the ocean's ears, and your lips to the eagle's ears, and to the ears of all of us who can hear in a new way and see with new eyes. Well, I don't think we can top that. That feels like the most perfect place to land our conversation. I feel like you both you spoke for so much of what I believe and expanded my understanding of what we're here to be and here to do and here to make and here to create and here to interweave. So thank you so much, Robert.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure.
Grateful. Gramil Maigish, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.